Tillman, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, Philly.
So, we know from physics that atoms are the basic units of matter. How does the atomic bomb work? And are you allowed to tell me? Will I be hunted down by the government in fear of me building one in my garage?
No, it's actually, the basic knowledge is pretty much out there. And in fact, there have been a couple of experiments that government agencies have conducted in a number of countries, but particularly in the US, where masters and PhD students in physics and engineering have been given the task of designing a nuclear bomb from publicly available information. And a couple of the academics involved in supervising that project said that, you know, if their students, masters or PhD physics and engineering students, couldn't design a functioning nuclear weapon in a couple of weeks with publicly available information, they didn't deserve to be where they were. So, yes, the basic information is actually pretty robust. And the Hiroshima bomb, so there's two materials that are commonly used to build nuclear weapons, highly enriched uranium and plutonium. And the key feature about them, why they're called fissile materials, is that if you put enough of them together in one place, then the natural decay that releases subatomic particles called neutrons that initiates a chain reaction will take off. And that can either be sort of moderated and controlled in a nuclear reactor or be allowed to happen explosively as happens in a bomb. The physics is pretty similar. So the two bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki were of different design. So the Hiroshima bomb used highly enriched uranium. The physics is so simple and robust that that bomb wasn't actually tested before it was used. They were so confident that it would work. There was a bit of overkill involved. They put about 60 kilograms of highly enriched uranium. In fact, less than a kilogram, about 900 grams of that actually fissioned.
Yeah.
The Nagasaki bomb was a little bit more complicated in that plutonium, so that was the type that was tested at the Trinity test in New Mexico on July 16, so a few weeks before the bombs were dropped in Japan. That requires a more sophisticated design, so that was tested first. But again, it was less than half a kilo of plutonium that was actually fissioned. Very small quantities of material can produce vast amounts of energy, respectively 15 and 20,000 tons of high explosive equivalent.
So looking at the incidents in Japan, how did the radiation exposure affect the Hibakusha, the people who survived to this day?
Sure. Well, I mean, the effects of nuclear weapons, some of them are just, you know, very large versions of any explosive weapon. There's severe blast injuries that produce traumatic injuries. There's burns from both the direct heat as well as the fires ignited by nuclear weapons. And then there's this extraordinary, lingering, indiscriminate, invisible, persistent, silent radiation that's really insidious. If you get enough of a dose, then you will get sick acutely. So there's organ dysfunction, particularly the rapidly dividing cells in the body that produce the elements of your blood and the lining of your gut are the most affected. So people can succumb. If they get enough of a dose, you can die within hours, essentially, from brain dysfunction. But most often it's illness that occurs within days and weeks that's characterized by bleeding and infection. And this was, of course, before these bombings, this was really unknown. So people who seemed to be recovering, would suddenly succumb a couple of weeks later, and that was really not well understood. And then with any dose of radiation, long-term, there's an increased risk of cancer and other chronic diseases, particularly heart attacks and strokes, that persists for the life of those individuals. And then also because one of the main features of radiation is that it can damage the genetic material, the DNA that, you know, is our most precious inheritance and the most precious legacy we leave to the next generations. Because that can be damaged, there can be transmissible effects for the next generation as well. So that's, and that's of obviously concern. So there's a lot of anxiety related to, you know, and the people in Hiroshima, the Hibakusha, as you mentioned, had suffered a lot of stigma. You know, some of them were unable to marry, unable to get work, were sort of ostracized because they were considered contaminated or not likely to be able to have children or have a normal family life. Mm. So there are a variety of effects that really persist for the lifetime of the exposed individuals and potentially into next generations as well.
Yeah. So several years ago, Australia voted against banning nuclear weapons in the United Nations. Why is this stance controversial on the world stage, and why does Australia take it?
Well, that's a really important question, Felix. The Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, so this historic first time that nuclear weapons are really explicitly and comprehensively outlawed in international law, that was adopted at the United Nations in July of 2017, with a historic vote of 122-1. And for its role in that work, the Australian-founded ICAN campaign won the Nobel Peace Prize that year. So that treaty is a big deal, and that treaty will become international law when 50 states have ratified it. We're now up to 40. So we're quite hopeful that that will happen either before the end of this year or early next. That's really the only thing that's going well in the nuclear landscape. Otherwise, treaties are being shredded, new nuclear weapons are being developed, nuclear threats abound, and the overall assessment is that the danger is growing. So why does Australia oppose this treaty when we've signed on proudly and in some cases been a leader on the treaties that prohibit other weapons of mass destruction and other indiscriminate unacceptable weapons like biological and chemical weapons, landmines and cluster munitions? And the reason is essentially that Australia claims that US nuclear weapons are a guarantor of our national security to the extent that we're willing to provide assistance through some key facilities in Australia for their possible use, so their targeting and command and control. Mm. So we're essentially conflicted. You know, we can't be serious about nuclear weapons or preach to other countries that they shouldn't have them with any credibility while we claim that we need these weapons for our security. So that's the bind that Australia's in. And I think it's really important to say that it's clear that it's possible to have a military alliance with a state that has nuclear weapons under this treaty and still join the treaty and support disarmament, provided you don't have anything to do with that nuclear weapons threat. So a number of US allies, Thailand, New Zealand, the Philippines, have signed this treaty, and there's been no disruption to their ongoing military cooperation with the US because their cooperation doesn't involve nuclear weapons, but ours thus far does.
Mm. Well, all right. Thank you, Professor Tilman Ruff, for joining us here on Drive this afternoon. It's been so fascinating hearing about this history, the science behind it, and our Australian contexts. If people wanted to find more about this, where can they go?
Well, I think the best place is the ICAN website. There's lots of good information and resources, so icanw.org.au.
All right. Well, fantastic. We'll have links to that up on the podcast. It's been a pleasure having you join us this afternoon.
Many thanks, Felix.